These things are so awful, and the debate has opened up in the UK in such a way that even NHS England has at least tentatively said that puberty blockers should no longer be given to teenagers by routine, only in very exceptional circumstances. But this is a big step forward. It's not the end of the story.
No.
It's the start of the end, maybe, perhaps, in terms of medicalisation at least.
Hello, I'm Anne McElhenney, and welcome to the Anne and Film Scoop with Anne McElhenney on her own, flying solo today. Film is off with what I had last week, so he has a terrible cough. And it's terrible because yesterday, we're taping on a Monday, and yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, and we were meant to have people over for St. Patrick's Day shindig. And we had to spend the whole morning telling people, don't come, Phelan was so unwell, and he's not great today either, so I'm all on my lonesome, but I'm going to do my best. Here's a photograph of us, by the way, celebrating St. Patrick's Day when we were happy and healthy. There you go, there's a little photograph of us. But in this week's show, I was in Missouri last week, speaking to Missouri Right to Life, and they're going to probably have a ballot initiative in November. Why are the pro-life side losing, and what can we do? I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a moment. And there are some signs of sanity happening across the Atlantic. Last week, as you'll remember, Phelan talked about how the Irish voted down woke constitutional amendments to the Irish Constitution. And then last week, the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, have decided to block puberty blockers for children. So I'll be talking to Baroness Claire Fox about this in a few moments. And I have a book recommendation that I'll talk about at the very end of the show. But first, I was in Missouri, and the pro-abortion people are looking for 170,000 signatures to get a ballot measure onto the ballot for November. They need to get them by May the 5th, and speaking to people down there, it looks very likely that the pro-abortion people will succeed in getting this onto the ballot. And so that's going to be a big moment for Missouri, and it's not good. These ballot measures are not working out very well for people who are pro-life. I'm just putting up on the screen there, you'll see. Obviously, many of you probably know because you're very informed, but there have been 7 of these ballot initiatives so far across the United States. 7. In each case, the pro-life people have lost in every one of them. And one thing that I think is interesting is even the language of the ballot initiatives. So in California, you know, the ballot initiatives, you know, the ones put forward by the pro-abortion people are very positive, have very positive language. It sounds kind of good. It's like choice and rights and stuff, you know. And I always say, I make the joke about choice. Who's not for choice? I love Costco. You know, I mean, so they use this very positive language, and the pro-life people seem to use very negative language. I'll give you an example. So of these ballot initiatives that have happened so far, the California ballot initiative was Proposition 1, the right to reproductive freedom. So you got all kinds of nice words in there, right and freedom, you know. The one in Michigan was the right to reproductive freedom, again. The one in Vermont was the right to personal reproductive autonomy. All kinds of words and all kinds of things that people, you know, love the sound of, actually. Then Kansas, the pro-lifers were putting the ballot initiative on there, and their language ended up being no. The first word was no. It's not good, the word no. It's a bit, people don't love the word no. No state constitutional right to abortion and legislative power to regulate abortion amendment. Also too many words there. And that Kansas did not succeed with that amendment. Kentucky, again, the first word was no. No right to abortion, the Constitution amendment. In Montana, medical care requirement for born alive infants measure. I'm surprised at, because again, they lost that measure. And I think what Montana were trying to do there was to try to focus people's minds on the baby, and make them think about the baby in the womb. And the legislation there was to protect a child born alive in an abortion, that they would get medical care. And they lost that initiative. And then, as you all know, November of 2023, Ohio had a ballot initiative, and it was the right to make reproductive decisions, including abortion initiative. Again, very positive language. And again, the pro-life side lost. in 2024, this year, there's going to be a bunch more of these. We still don't know exactly how many there will be, because some of them are still waiting on signatures like Missouri, but there'll be a bunch of them. And, you know, I wanted to kind of just for a minute, you know, reflect on why it is that the pro-life side are losing all the time. And, you know, some of the reasons you probably, you know, can sort of guess, you know. So certainly they're outspent. The pro-abortion side has a shed load of money. A ton of money has been dumped. So, for example, in Ohio, a huge amount of money, by the way. God, it's desperate to think about how much money was spent. But I think the pro-life side spent, you know, just south of $30 million. But the pro-abortion side spent twice that. That's one thing. It's not everything, though. The money isn't everything. The other problem is that the pro-abortion side tell lies, and they have the media to support those lies. So the lie, for example, women die. Women are dying. Women die. Women will die. You know, try to argue against that. It's very, very compelling. It's not true, but it's still very powerful. And when you have the media affirming that lie and propagating it all over the place, it's really, really tough. Then you have Hollywood, who, you know, and I think we've mentioned this on the podcast before, you know, Planned Parenthood have a woman called Karen Spruce. There's a photograph of her up on the screen. And this is from the Washington Post. Karen Spruce, her full-time job, paid a very handsome salary for Planned Parenthood to insert into entertainment pro-abortion narratives. And she's really successful. And the media, as I said, the media are also supplying all these stories. And the Hollywood one is extraordinary. I mean, you know, just recently we watched Chicago Med, and they had a very, very pro-abortion, very anti-pro-life message, where they had a woman, and the story was, you know, again, you know, it was very simplified. But the woman comes along on a gurney, and the baby is dead, and she's come from another state where they wouldn't help her because they didn't want to be, you know, because the doctors were too frightened. But the baby was dead, you know, and so the woman was going to die. She was going to die if she couldn't have the fetus removed, the dead baby removed. But the other state wouldn't do it. This is complete nonsense. This is complete nonsense based on no truth at all. But it's very effective and very emotional and beautifully produced. And 6 million people watch that. And it's those layers and layers. So when a ballot initiative will come up in Missouri, the pro-life side are already on the back foot because they're starting with a population in Missouri who may have, quite a number of them may have watched Chicago Med and watched all the other things that are being constantly produced by Hollywood that, you know, that lie about abortion. And it's, you know, it's really interesting. I just, before I started recording today, I decided to look up, you know, I put into Google at most extreme abortion laws in the United States. I Googled, you know, what would come up if I put in most extreme abortion laws in the US? And what comes up immediately is Indiana and West Virginia. You can see it there. I'm putting it on the screen. Became the first states to pass new laws banning abortion, you know, whatever, you know, but they highlight that. What I was actually looking for was this information, which I'm going to put on the screen now, which is that in Alaska, Colorado, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Puerto Rico, Vermont, and Washington, D.C., abortion is legal with no limits. And the truth is that in many, many other states, including California, really there's no limit on abortion at all. They use this if there's any danger to the life of the mother or her mental health. Those kind of laws, by the way, don't exist in Europe at all. So even in Europe, very, very liberal Europe, they do have limits. So that would be my definition of very extreme abortion laws, that you can have abortion up to 9 months, you know, and this is what you can do in Colorado. And I actually question, and I've often said this, and I really wonder the answer. I question if people in Colorado actually know that. I question if people in Alaska know, in New Jersey know, that they have laws that allow abortion at 9 months. But it got me thinking about what can we do, you know, what can we do in this context? What can we do to try and change things? And it's very, very difficult. Obviously, the pro-abortion people know that telling stories and producing entertainment that tells a pro-abortion story is very effective, and that's why they spend so much money on it. And it got me thinking about the power of the movie that we made, the power of the movie Gosnell. And I just went back and I was sharing this with people in Missouri, and I was saying to them, and I actually distributed 100 copies of the Gosnell movie to the people there. And I said to them, and I kind of did this eyeball with them, and I said, here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to give you this DVD for free, but I want you to get a bunch of people over to your house to watch it. I want you to go to the local school and try and have the local school show it. I want you to distribute it in the college where you're going. Try and get your friends to watch it. And the people that were there, obviously, the people I met at the Missouri Right to Life were just, you know, obviously the best people ever, really gorgeous. And I do believe that they will do this. And I'm hoping that they'll get back in touch with me and tell me how they get on. And I looked back at just some of the people who were affected by the Gosnell movie and what they said. And I'm going to start putting this stuff up on the screen because I think it's really interesting of how powerful a movie can be and how powerful stories can be. And here's the first one. It's by a guy called Adam Mill. I don't know who this guy is. Watching Gosnell shattered my agnosticism on abortion. The new movie reminds us that we need new moral courage when dealing with the harsh realities of abortion. And he goes on, if you haven't seen the movie Gosnell, it is required viewing for Americans like me, who avoided the abortion issue because I lacked the moral courage to really think about it and form my own opinion. And it goes on. Underneath that, here's somebody who gave it a 10-10. A must-see movie if you've always been pro-choice. As a pro-choice promoter for the majority of my life, this movie opened my eyes. I have had to reevaluate my position. Must see to see the real story. I mean, this is very powerful. This is what 90 minutes can do. This is the power of entertainment, the power of a movie. Rachel Lamb. To be honest, I never thought I'd be a one-issue voter until Gosnell. The evil that was ignored because it was an abortion clinic and the lack of coverage. Now, all other issues aside, I'm more likely to vote on this one issue. Teresa Dickershare. I was strong pro-choice for 50 years. This movie absolutely changed my mind 100%. Thank you for bringing this to light. I'm not going to read the whole thing there. You know, somebody else. I bought your movie today. I used to be pro-choice, but not anymore. Thank you. Another person, Nina Worsley. I used to be personally pro-life, politically pro-choice. Gosnell cemented my stance in pro-life in all capacities. I've never been more grateful. And I've always considered myself as pro-choice for many reasons. After watching Gosnell, the trial of America's biggest serial killer, I'm rethinking this stance. I paid $5.99 to rent this movie. It was worth every penny. It's a very, very difficult fight that people in Michigan and many other people will be facing all over the country. And we want to offer as much help as we can. And anyone, please get in touch with us with ideas. And we are coming up with lots of ideas of our own as well. Just to tell the truth and let people make their decisions based on the truth. At the moment, people aren't getting the truth. They're getting this very one-sided story that is full of errors and full of lies. And so I recommend to people to watch the Gosnell movie and get people to come around to your house and watch it with you, because I can't believe it's still very gratifying, to be honest, to look at this, to read this and to realise the power of the movie and how much it changed people. So I'm very happy, very, very happy about that. I'm going to go over right now to this interview we did earlier with Baroness Claire Fox, who is just extraordinary. And she has, you know, some good news from across the pond, which I think we could all do with a little bit of good news. Let's go over to that now. I'm joined now by our dear friend Claire Fox, who is also known as Baroness Fox of Buckley. She is the director of the Academy of Ideas, which she established to promote the shocking concept that a public space where ideas can be contested without constraint is a good idea. Claire is a member of the House of Lords. Welcome to the Anne and Phelan Scoop with just Anne today, Claire.
It's good to be here, and lots of love to Phelan.
Thank you very much. Did you enjoy St. Patrick's Day? Do you celebrate St. Patrick's Day, Claire?
So it used to be like the day of the year for me. But of course you get a bit old, don't you?
Yeah.
So I kind of, you know, I nodded in the direction of celebrating it. And I was obviously delighted that Ireland had won the rugby the day before. So some alcohol was consumed, but not quite the wild ways of my youth.
Yes, yeah, we're all going in that direction. We were supposed to have a St. Patrick's Day party, and we had to spend all of St. Patrick's Day morning telling people, don't come to our house, please, because we're all full of disease. Before we get to the NHS's decision, Claire, Can you explain why and how the world has been captured by this trans madness?
Well, not easily, but I will do a couple of nods in that direction. First of all, I think that for most of us, and this is a lesson for other issues, as we were fully committed to equal rights and equal treatment under the law for lesbian and gay people and bisexual people, but there had been absolute proper legal discrimination of lesbian and gay people in the UK, in Europe, in the US and so on. It was a great success story when that equality was achieved in the law, and some of the as it were, the hangover of discrimination carried on. And an organization associated with that equality and that fight for equality was Stonewall, named Stonewall. So when then Stonewall started to kind of add letters of the alphabet to the LGB bit, I mean, in a way we didn't, and maybe we didn't quite think about it, you know, it's like LGBTQI plus, you're kind of performatively just going along with it without necessarily understand. I'm not entirely convinced that many of us understood what the letters stood for in many instances, but you're kind of nodding along to be on the right side of history. At the same time, it became apparent that something peculiar was occurring because the issue of trans and transgenderism came to the fore. Now, for me, just in terms of the way I noticed it because I have written and have spoken a lot about education. And I noticed that schools were increasingly inviting in transgender activists, well-known people, to talk to sixth formers. And the message was, you can be whoever you want to be. You can be whatever you want to be. No, don't let anyone tell you that you can't be who you want to be. Now, that might sound fairly anodyne until you realise that, first of all, as an educator, I bristled because I thought the last thing we want is a bunch of 14, 15, 16-year-olds saying, I'm not going to let an adult tell me that, you know, I need to be restricted in any way, because if you're a teacher, that's a pain in the neck. But then you actually realise there was something slightly more sinister going on, because it started to take the form of saying, if you're not happy in your body, you can change your body. And that your self-defined identity can be whatever you want it to be. Now, this is I'm saying it in this kind of slightly naive way, because I think that it kind of crept up on some of us, you know, like that was like, and you kind of think that's a bit odd. And then you suddenly appreciated that unbeknownst to us, bells of Westminster are ringing in the background, by the way, but unbeknownst to us, that this organization, Stonewall, had also developed a system of going to every major institution in the UK, in the United Kingdom, and suggesting that if they wanted to show that they were in support of lesbian, gay, bi, right, with TQI, which nobody knew what it stood for, they should stand up as an equality champion, pay Stonewall somebody. Stonewall, we weren't to worry, because Stonewall would basically be able to give you lessons in how you could improve your championship markings and ratings, and if you want, a scam was born, right? And all, you can imagine every public sector organisation in the UK did this because they wanted everyone to think that they were nice people who were interested in equality, and then at the same time the corporate sector was imitating the public sector and wanting to prove, particularly because of the financial crash, big discussions in the business community, in the banking community, in every corporate, oh, everybody hates us. They think that we're ruthless and that we don't care about livelihoods and we need to be more ethical. What can we do? And then Stonewall walks in the room and says, oh, why not sign up for us? Now, a parallel thing has happened indeed in relation to race relations, but I'm just talking about this particular one. Now, I think the final bit of this puzzle, because then we can do a bit more digging in, is that we had been for years having a bit of an adult existential crisis about young people and saying, oh, the problem for young people is that they're all developing poor mental health because we're undermining their self-esteem by being too horrible to them. And this was a way of effectively a political campaign against adult authority, either of teachers or of parents, the self-esteem movement was that you had to nod along to whatever a young person wanted. And as they were getting this idea that if you hated your own body, which, by the way, every young woman
yes.
goes through puberty, hates their own body, in my opinion, generally. But they were then saying, there's a medical solution to this. You know, it's not your fault. And the adults in the room went, oh, my God, the young people are saying they want to change from being a girl to a boy. And who are we as adults to undermine their self-esteem by saying no? And then the medicalization of that more existential discussion started to be felt in relation to things like puberty blockers.
Yeah, but you know, you talk about adults in the room. I mean, that's one of the parts of this whole thing that I find so difficult to stomach is every institution is captured, and institutions where parents who are in an awful state have nowhere to, you know, have had nowhere to turn. But in the midst of all of that, then there's this incredibly good news from last week, which kind of for me came out of the blue. This NHS decision. First of all, can you tell us what the NHS decided last week, and what, I mean, I'm very surprised at it. What's the context? Why did this happen?
Yeah, so I think partly the context is that, you know, one of the reasons why quite a lot of adults in the room couldn't perform as adults in the room is when they tried, they were cancelled. They were, you know, all the things we're familiar with in relation to cancel culture, called out as bigots, transphobic, had their reputations trashed. And that led to a great deal of self-censorship. But one thing that's happened in the UK in the last maybe 4 or 5 years is somebody said that we've become Turf Island. The UK has actually led the fight back of people saying, you can't call me a bigot because of this. Now, some people have argued this is because the UK had a bit of a shake-up in 2016 around Brexit, and although Brexit, there's a big row about whether it had any use or not. In a way, the UK had to kind of, there was an element in which British politics was shaken up. People had to say, oh, well, we don't just nod along to the EU's rules on this, or what do we think about this? So that was one thing. And just secondly, just some very brave and courageous, particularly gender critical feminists and members of the lesbian and gay activists who had set up Stonewall originally and was so infuriated that it was being hijacked that they then got embroiled. The British government did set up the Cass Review, and the Cass Review was where Dr. Hilary Cass looked at the gender, the clinics associated with dealing with young people with gender dysphoria, and found this huge percentage rise in young people declaring that they wanted to change gender, but looked at some of the real problems of often autistic children or young people who were lesbian and gay but didn't want to admit that, being put on a pathway and affirmed towards a change of gender. Right, that's the background. This has been a big argument, and I do think that the breaking of the W path files by leaks by Michael Schellenberger and his team have been just one of the many things that there's been more and more of an expose that actually the medical intervention is one thing, socially transitioning young people by going along with their name changes and their gender pronouns, but to actually give them medication that will stop their puberty mean that you would have a menopause at the age of 12 if you have it early or whatever it might be, untested drugs that you're actually calling for if it's, you know, potentially a double mastectomy on a healthy body of a teenage girl or castration of a boy, that these drugs are increasingly known to, for example, lead to infertility, and that the side effects of the medical interventions could mean that young people are making a decision at the age of 15, 16 that will mean that they won't feel any sexual pleasure at all when they're older. These things are so awful, and the debate has opened up in the UK in such a way that even the NHS England, which is the body that has administered over this, has at least tentatively said that puberty blockers should no longer be given to teenagers by routine, only in very exceptional circumstances of medical trials, which a lot of us aren't happy with. But this is a big step forward. It's not the end of the story.
No.
it's the start of the end, maybe, perhaps, in terms of medicalization at least.
Yeah, because I think one of the things, and I think somebody was commenting on that last week, that the schools are going to continue to teach this gender ideology and promote the gender ideology, despite what the NHS have said. So that it's, yeah, you know, it's, but it's a very, but it's a lot more than what is happening in a lot of other places. So I
no, exactly. It's a break, Anne, isn't it? It's a breakthrough. I mean, there has also been an attempt. I mean, I have to give credit. The Conservative Party as a government since 2019, which was, we associate that with the kind of the Brexit government, has been, by the way, the most disappointing betrayal of most of the aspirations of British people.
Yes.
However,
yeah.
There's been some independent-minded politicians. People like Kemi Badenoch, who is the Equalities Minister, and various other people. And I think that on the issue of this sex and gender, we have made some strides. So there is also new guidance going out to school that means that teachers are no longer required to use pronouns, and pupils are no longer required to be compelled to use the pronoun of a student who says, call me a he, or, you know, when they're a she, some of these things. But one of the things, because I asked a question in the House of Lords about it, that guidance went out. That's had an influence, by the way, on on the NHS England, because I think there's just institutions beginning to realise that there's a problem here, and that also, by the way, that they might get sued in litigious circumstances in the future, particularly the medical profession, for actually physically damaging people. But the thing was, when the government issued this guidance for schools, which also said that parents had to be told if a young person declared that they wanted to change gender, the teachers' unions, all the NGOs, lots of educational organisations, and many senior management in schools just said, are we going to ignore the school's guidance? So I asked a question in the House of Lords, and there's now a move to make that guidance mandatory rather than it just being the guidance that you should follow, that it's the guidance you need to follow or you'll be breaching some kind of law. And I think the fact that this is so deeply embedded, because despite these great step forwards, most people in powerful positions and institutions in the UK do not agree with what I'm saying. They would cancel me now for saying it. And the vast majority of ordinary working people in the UK know that this is common sense. Some politicians know it's common sense. Those people who are interested in women's rights know it's common sense. Lots of people who are from religious backgrounds know it's common. I mean, you know, all sorts of both the traditional right and more radical, you know, lesbian rights groups, whatever. We all agree on all sorts of things, left and right. But the powerful people who run the institutions don't agree. And so it's a relief that NHS England has done this. But I'll bet you anything, the propaganda in the NHS will double down in terms of, for example, saying that men can breastfeed. That was one recently, where basically the juice that can be that's created by, in a male who's had hormones it was even declared, you know, is healthier for babies than a mother's breast milk. Just the grossness of that. And that comes from a hospital, right?
Oh my God, I'm actually going to stop you for 1 minute there, Claire, because I want to play that we're going to play that clip of you telling that story about the breast milk in the House of Lords. We'll just play that right now.
In contrast, former BBC senior broadcast journalist Kath Walters wrote in The Critic magazine recently about the way BBC managers demanded she delete a tweet criticising the term cis women within an hour of it being posted, followed by a lengthy disciplinary process in which her gender-critical views were treated as wrongthink. Ms Walters' article was prompted by recent instances where the BBC's lack of impartiality in relation to sex and gender has led to seriously misleading audiences. Recently, BBC viewers were informed that men can breastfeed. Spoiler, they can't. With a non-binary identifying expert alleging, unchallenged, that the hormone-induced discharge from a trans woman's nipples is better for babies than a mother's breast milk. What misogynistic claptrap. Where's BBC Verify and Ofcom when you need them?
Sometimes, in the name of impartiality, facts are described as opinions due to institutionalised ideological partisanship. The BBC recently upheld a complaint against Radio 4's Justin Webb that ruled he broke impartiality rules when explaining a story with the factually accurate, true remark, trans women, in other words, male. Finally, there's the sins of omission. Why has the BBC been absent and silent in covering the scandal of safeguarding risks associated with puberty blockers for the young? Now the NHS England has banned these for teens, the BBC commissioned its LGBTQ plus correspondent to tell the story, not the science reporters to discuss the medical scandals. I'm glad to say GB News has been following this, covering this and leading on this for years.
Tell us this story about this breast milk. This is, you know, this is sort of Twilight Zone stuff where, you know, this kind of thing is out there and you're thinking how... I think it's a little bit like Brexit in a way. There's something similar where, as you've just explained, very ordinary people get it. Lots and lots of people get it, but the people at the top of these institutions, at these elite institutions, are talking this madness and getting away with it and trying to censor and shut up people who say otherwise. Tell us about this breast milk madness.
Well, I think it's because the health service in general, forgetting this recent positive mood about puberty blockers, the whole of the National Health Service has set about, as many institutions have, the removal of, the erasure of any sex-specific language or healthcare. So, for example, you know, there are ridiculous situations whereby you have menopause support and you cannot say that the menopause is for women. So you have to have menopause. So, you know, whether the health service should be providing that support is a bigger question. It's another question, rather. But if you're going to have it, it should obviously be aimed at the people who are going to have a menopause. But the whole thing gets clogged up because, you know, if you are no longer allowed to say that a woman has a vagina, you know, and you can't talk about sex-specific genitals. So you have to say, instead of breastfeeding, you have to say chest feeders. And when I first came in the House of Lords, I was quite a controversial person when I put in the House of Lords, and I thought I was going to play safe and speak on an issue that wouldn't get me into any controversy. And so I put my name down to speak on an issue about maternity leave.
Right.
I thought that was pretty safe. Yeah. I fought for women's rights all my life. I thought, there we go. And then the problem was I read the actual piece of legislation. I realized the bill on maternity leave didn't mention the word mother or women anywhere. And I thought, that's a bit, what? And then I kind of raised it. Anyway, it became the fight of my political life to get the word mother inserted into the maternity. So I thought I was going to be playing nice with this nice little soft bill and end up being a big fight. And by the way, we had to compromise on only getting mother in. They wouldn't accept the word woman in. And you've got to remember, this is a conservative government that was doing this, right? Well. This was like not mad social justice warriors. And I immediately, any of us who fought for that would call bigots and all the rest of it, right? So in other words, every single institution is chosen to eradicate any sex differences. You cannot any longer rely on crime statistics because police forces are either collecting sex registered at birth or your gender identity or what have you. They pick and choose, right? So you can't say how many rapists there are or how many people are victims of rape or who is the rapist, because these days you can read headlines or look at the figures and the police say, we've just arrested a woman for paedophilia and abusing young people. And then they say, she played with her penis in front of the children. And you think, yes, she hasn't got to be, it's a he, but they won't say that. So the health service has got embroiled in this. And it means that when we get onto this breast milk question, that males who transition to become trans women have to take a lot of hormones, but want to, as it were, cosplay being a woman. And in order to do that, one of the things that they note is that they are capable of breastfeeding just like any biological woman. But what they do is they actually manipulate their nipples that produce, and because they've taken hormones, a certain amount of juice is produced. and they try and pretend that they're lactating that juice is the same as a mother of a newborn infant and the milk they could. I mean, it's so gross that I can't believe I'm having the conversation with you. But that's effectively the story. And rather than this being kind of like, everybody dismissing this as completely unscientific nonsense and prejudiced against women and ridiculous, sadly, there are academics and people in the health service who go along with it. And so that, in a way, is still rampant. Those kind of attitudes still rampant within the health service. But it is not to say that I'm not excited that they've banned the use of puberty blockers on children. But that's only one very small aspect of the way this ideology has really seeped into all sides of institutions such as the health service.
It's incredible. I mean, it's just, I suppose the one thing I compare it to all the time to eugenics. Like, eugenics was incredibly popular and it was hugely popular, particularly, by the way, in America. And all the right-thinking people were eugenicists. You know, it was huge, and it's gone away, obviously, but it was amazing that the things that were said, Wendell Holmes, by the way, this incredible jurist, the Supreme Court justice, three generations of imbeciles is enough. He said that, he said that and got away with saying that. It's similar.
The Fabians in this country, the Fabians, who were the the people who started the Labour Party, the Fabians are the big progressives. Absolute eugenicists, right? Completely, didn't trust the working class to have children. How could we stop them having children? Exactly that vein. And I think that analogy is very well made, Anne.
Thank you. But it's, because there's something, it's Twilight Zone stuff, and you start to really, but people, sensible people are standing up. And obviously we had the great news from Ireland last week, which was, the week before.
Absolutely, yes.
Fantastic. And what I love about it, of course, is it's hilarious to listen to the media and the pundits and all the very wise people. And their basic line is, well, the people are a bit stupid, I think you can nearly summarize it as, people, it was too, the language was too complicated. Well, the language was too complicated. In other words, people are very stupid in Ireland. No, the people weren't stupid at all. They really, really actually understood what they were being asked to do, to erase the word women, And it's like, we're not having it.
This is something that I think we've seen in all these issues, and I think it's a constant theme, which is that there is a... the new elite who have power, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm saying this as a member of the House of Lords, but this kind of like new elite of attitude with a particular set of perspectives, they recognise that they're a smaller group of people than others, and this is kind of this whole outlook on the world is the new snobbery, it's the kind of new kind of the masses are backward. We all speak the same language. We know what we mean. We're on the right side of history. We're the progressive minority, and we need to educate these kind of oiks and these backward, ignorant people who are either too old, because often the accusation is, you're just not young enough to understand the nuances, or you're too stupid, you're not using the correct language. So it becomes a way of intervening and telling people to speak properly. And they can recognize each other in the language and the linguistic tricks they use. And they can, in terms of pronoun use, for example, or whether you say LGBTQ+ and so on and so forth. And they also kind of nod knowingly if you misspeak. And of course, many of us refuse to be compelled to use the nonsense language that they demand of us. But then they're kind of like nod knowingly. And then you know that you're out of the picture. And of course, for a lot of younger people, understandably, you go to college or university or even, go to work, because it's not just university students. You go and they sort of say, are you a bigot? Or are you a nice person?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Guess what? Thankfully, because they're lovely young people, idealistic, they say, I'm not a bigot. And they say, well, they're the bigots over there, that small one. We're the nice people. And they might not be that political, particularly they've not really thought it through, but they just say, they go along with it, not because they're stupid, but because they've been told that
that is
bigotry.
Yep, yep.
And so on. And so I think it's wrong for us to see that all young people go along with this, very often they by default are assumed to. Those of them who then wish to challenge it because they've become a bit more politicized around it, or they've got a challenge, you know, they want to say, actually, no, I don't agree with this, are then absolutely treated with the most vehement hostility by their peers, socially isolated, treated, bullied, called out. And of course, that then sends a message to other 18, 19-year-olds that maybe they better, like, not ask any awkward questions because they don't want to destroy their lives at 18, 19 by being written off as some bigot.
That's right. Yeah? And you'd like to be with you want to be with the nice group. That kind of brings up.
Yeah, and so do I, by the way. Yeah. So do I. Who doesn't? I don't want to be with horrible.
That's right. I want to get invited to the party as well. You know, it's kind of like that kind of thing. The other thing, Claire, that's come up recently, and I just, this is going to be the last question I want to ask you, is Michael Gove is trying. Explain it to me, because I just read this the other day. So he's trying to redefine the word extremism. Is that correct, or has he achieved it, or he's trying to do it, or what's happening with extremism now? The word extremism.
Yeah. So what has happened is that an MP, there's a new MP being elected called George Galloway, who's an independent MP, who in a particularly fraught by-election after one MP died, the Labour Party candidate ended up being struck off by the Labour Party. They withdrew support for him because he was found to have, you know, there was a recording of him making some quite explicitly anti-Semitic remarks. And George Galloway, this independent, who's a firebrand supporter of, really an Islamist outlook and, you know, a real openly hatred of Israel and so on. And I think he would say that he thinks that Israel is the epitome of the colonial settler state and things you're familiar with. And I won't rehearse it all. But he won the election. This is quite a big deal, right? And a lot of the argument, it was said at least, that there was some intimidation of people in the local election campaign. And this sat at the same time that there was a big row in Parliament about whether there should be a vote on whether there was going to be whether the UK Parliament should call for a ceasefire. And in the course of the row about whether to even call that vote, it was alleged that MPs on all sides of different political parties were too frightened to vote in particular ways, that they were being intimidated and threatened, and they kind of felt that they needed to be able to vote for a ceasefire or they would really have their safety threatened. Now, this atmosphere is, we've seen it in America, I know it's happening everywhere, which is a sense of again, this is kind of, you know, if you are defensive of Israel's right to defend itself, and if you are not one of the people who goes on the marches in support of Gaza and makes a particular issue about Israel's, you know, alleged genocide, if you don't go along with that, then you are seen to be genocide deniers, you are really under attack and so on and so forth. So in that background, the British government are anxious and nervous about the fact that there's growing anti-Semitism. And there's also a growing atmosphere of support for radical Islam, Islamism, which is not the same as, and there's a lot, by the way, there is a substantial majority of immigrants into the UK are Muslims, and even though only a minority of those Muslims are radically attracted to Islamism rather than just the religion of Islam, nonetheless, they are the dominant voices in this debate. And so there's this sort of like tension and everyone's very anxious because I myself, as an anti-racist of long standing, do not want there to be a backlash against ordinary Muslim, you know, people living in the UK, because people are so frustrated that we won't deal with the radical Islamists who are on the streets shouting anti-Semitic abuse on demonstrations or threatening people on campuses. So there's all this tension. So what do the government do? The government, because they're idiots, in my opinion, decide that instead of actually having this argument out, trying to confront the fact that there's been this growth of Islamism, that people are frightened to criticise Islamism in case you're accused of Islamophobia, that word that is so broadly used to silence debate on what's wrong with radical Islam, that has led to, by the way, 94 people in this country being killed over the years by, ISIS supporting Islamists. If you criticise anything to do with Islamism, you're accused of being anti-Muslims, Islamophobic and shut down. So the government think we've got to do something. And they therefore say, we're going to tighten up on our definition of extremism. And if you express any extremist views, we might well ban your organization. They mean Islamist extremist views, probably, but they haven't got the courage to say it. So they make this sort of very broad definition. They then equate Islamism with far-right views, and there are far-right organizations in the UK, as there are in every country, as there is in every country, but they are a tiny, small, fringe, crank group. The difficulty is that a lot of people who are called far-right are actually people who, for example, do not go along with LGBTQ plus orthodoxies, or say that you shouldn't give children puberty blockers, and then they say you're far-right, transphobic, blah, blah. So that's what's happened. And it's a disaster. The government have announced that they're going to clamp down on extremism. And I can assure you, your channel would go.
Yes.
A lot of the work, yeah. A lot of my speeches, even in Parliament, the House of Lords would be cast as far as extremists. And anyway, that's not the way to deal with this. I mean, you can say these extremists challenge British values, but nobody knows what British values are because we won't have the open discussion.
We had a conversation with you, I know, a couple of years ago, talking about maybe a year ago. And it's something that I'm really conscious of now, is that, and it's exactly what you're saying, everything should be debated. Everything should be out in the open and people should be talking, and good ideas will win, in a good debate. It'll be like, yeah, that makes sense. But instead of that, what I think seems to be happening, and I think you agree with this, is that the far left or the actual extremists won't engage. They won't do debates. I mean, there was a famous case here where I think it was Joe Rogan, who has the biggest podcast on the planet Earth or whatever. He put up something like $9 million, I think it ended up being, some huge number, to have Anthony Fauci, debate with whoever had something else to say about the whole COVID thing. I thought it was a marvellous opportunity for Fauci to pick up $9 million, which is always very pleasant, that he could have given to charity or whatever, but also to defend, what had happened during COVID and stuff. Like, a great opportunity. Huge audience would have come for that. Massive people. What's his name?
Peter Hotez,
right? Who, of course, apparently, obviously, is some kind of evil person. But, I mean, he hasn't been arrested for anything. But Fauci wouldn't do it. But basically, there's been a lot of this where they won't debate. They don't need to debate, you see, because they're winning, right?
No, they don't need to debate. But the thing I think, though, is that we do. And what I think is, even if we're doing it in our silos and our echo chambers, there's an audience who are not sure. And if we just try and deal with them by shutting them down, then guess what? They're going to come for us to shut us down. But we actually, it's the hearts and minds of the millions of people who are not quite sure that we need to influence. And it's utterly galling and frustrating that we can't directly debate them because they won't debate. And I agree with you on that. I mean, there's a real, I mean, that the attitude of the kind of social justice left, as I call them, the identitarian left, whatever way you want to describe them. And I say that because I consider myself to be on the left, but not part of that guard. But the reason I'm saying that is because they try to avoid debating us by delegitimizing our arguments and saying that we're far-right fascists or what have you, right? And that way, it's like, why would you bother in, or cranks or lunatics or whatever? So it's like, why do you need to even bother to debate them? But the difficulty I've got with the extremism point, the way that the Conservatives have dealt with this, is that sometimes we can also say, well, we won't debate, not with them, but we won't debate these ideas. They're not worth debating, because, so we'll ban them, right? And the problem is, it glamorizes them. It gives them a sort of free speech martyrdom that they do not deserve. And it means that we get let off the hook from having better ideas and putting those out there in the public. And I think that there's a serious danger. I've just in a debate in the House of Lords, this has come up just today, actually, where I think that probably the majority of people in the UK are exceptionally hostile to Israel. That a lot of that spills into anti-Semitism. That there's a majority of people, including a majority of ordinary people, who feel like that. The prospect of the Gaza famine, all sorts of the horror stories coming out from Gaza, is having this impact of people just going along with this treatment of Israel. I know that, and I know that there's a visceral anti-Semitism that isn't challenged by anyone. It would be tempting to try and ban it, all those views, because I'm losing. But I can't win by banning things just because I'm losing. And if I'm on the minority side, I have an obligation to try and win over more people to what I think are far, you know, to explain why anti-Semitism is not just, I mean, it's first of all, it's racism on a par with anything else, but it's almost more than that, because it represents something when society adopts anti-Semitism in that way. Let's have these discussions. They're complicated. They're not that straightforward. You can't just moralize about them. So, yeah, the extremism response is one of avoiding difficult discussions. And ironically, guess what happened? It was exposed in the same 2 days or a day after they announced extremism thing, that a donor to the Conservative Party had made a racist comment. He'd given £10 million to the Conservative Party. And so for the days after they announced their extremism point, every time a Conservative minister would go on the television, they'd say, are you going to say that your donor was an extremist? Are you going to give the money back? That's all anyone's talked about. Nobody's talked about the real extremism, which is genuinely problematic, which is the rise of Islamism as an idea that people are frightened to challenge, and genuinely people are espousing, and it's creating a blasphemy law by the back door. It means that people are nervous about what they say, etc., etc. We're not talking about that. We're talking about whether the Conservative Party itself is an extremist organization. No surprise, but anyway.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I just, the power of the media, though, to, you know, to misinform or not inform or, you know, look over there, you know, do that kind of thing. I mean, my example of that was we were in Ireland on October 7th and October 8th, and I swim with a bunch of ladies and are just fabulous, great. But one of them said, we were coming out of the water, October 8th, one of them said, you know, they turned off the electricity in Gaza. And I thought, wow. I said, you're leading with that. You want to lead with that, are you? You know, and she's a great person. But it's all she had heard. You know, that's what the national broadcaster in Ireland were talking about. You know, they weren't talking about the hostages that people had been kidnapped. They weren't talking about the people who had been, you know, massacred. It's almost like it's like you're in an altered reality. I was looking at this person thinking, oh my God, what are you talking about electricity for? You know, but that's how they do it. It's very, very powerful. And now, of course, in Ireland, they're going to have this, we're going to have our version of the extremism thing. We're going to have these hate laws, which, you know, define hate, you know. And exactly, they're coming for us, basically, to try and shut us down. I think they're going to, maybe people are being extreme, but I've heard versions of this hate law in Ireland where the police would have the power to come into your house and look at your digital, you know, your computer and stuff, and see if you were designing a meme that was nasty.
That is in the bill. That is what the bill could do in Ireland. And also, we have a similar thing because we have a problem of devolution in the United Kingdom, which is that even though it's, you know, the United Kingdom, is it United, is it hell? Wales, which is where I'm from, and Scotland have devolved laws on certain issues, and Scotland is bringing in the most draconian hate bill legislation, which is likely to, I think it's going to be this week or next week, and it's on a par with the Irish hate legislation. It's absolutely terrifying, and they've got a thing about what you discuss in your own home. Even Police Scotland, the police force of Scotland, have said this is so draconian, we'll be arresting everyone. And that's what Scottish government say, well, this is the only way that we can ensure that we're protecting vulnerable people from hearing offensive damaging, dangerous ideas. Well, you know, this is the way things are going. So let's take advantage of that. We can talk as we are on this alternative media, Anne, because, you know, it won't be long.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly true. Yeah, let's take advantage of it while we can. Claire, I'm going to leave you. You're so kind to have given us all this time today. We could talk to you for the whole day. I don't know if there's any good news out there. I suppose X, I have to say, is one piece of good news. I feel like that's one positive thing that I think Elon Musk, I love the fact that, you know.
And also, maybe I can finish on a positive note. And also people must actually check out what I do at the Academy of Ideas and our work. But there is such an appetite amongst ordinary British people for common sense in the way that, and just like you said, that was expressed in the Irish referendum, but also amongst young people, so many young people we work with, they just need the adults to give them the space to be able to say, actually, we are not Generation Snowflake. We're not going along with this. And we need to, you know, basically give a lead. And what's refreshing is how many brilliant young people there are who are ready really to step up into this space. So I'm ever hopeful, despite my description of a degenerate, moribund political climate. The world doesn't stand still, right?
No, and then...
And they're not going to win this because we believe in freedom. And many people have that instinct, even if they haven't got the years of bitter experience that we have.
Yeah, faced. No. And by the way, you know, positive examples, you know, Brexit was obviously an amazing moment. I still remember where I was that evening. And Phelim and I were in, you know, in Los Angeles. And I thought we were in for the evening. I thought, okay, we got drinks in and whatever. This is going to be a whole evening. And it was over before it started. It was over within about an hour or something. And it was like, and it was just such a great, such a wonderful time. I'd love to have been in London or anywhere in the UK because it was just such fun. And I think, wasn't it, Nigel Farage had like gone home or something, or gone off to the pub or something, and people came running after him saying, no, it's over. And just brilliant. So positive developments can happen.
I think the populist genie's out of the bottle. It's not going back anytime soon. We're living in a historic period. We don't quite know what it will look like because we're in the middle of it. But what we do know is the centre won't hold, and nothing's there's everything to fight for, called the future. And these elites are trying to build a new world through the destruction of old language, the creation of new linguistic rules, and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's a tussle. And we stand a fair chance.
Yes. And we have to be happy warriors. Okay, we're going to stop right now. Claire, thank you so much. And let's do this again soon, please. Well, that was amazing. Claire is, wonderful. I mean, she gives me confidence and hope, I suppose, because she doesn't stop fighting. And we're going to put up in the show notes ways where you can read more about Claire. She has a Substack, and her Substack, Claire Fox, will be in the show notes. And really, honestly, you should, you know, subscribe. She is fascinating and an incredible fighter. She never gives up. Really, really powerful. And we'll definitely have her back on because she's great. And I didn't want to end the show, actually, but I was saying something else, you know, sharing something else that I think is powerful. This book here, Foster by Claire. This is just very random. So when I was very sick over the last week, and I'm still not over it, you probably hear me coughing a little bit, or there's a cough in my throat. I read this little book, very short little book called Foster. It's by an Irish writer called Claire Keegan. It's just a really very simple, beautiful book that I would highly recommend. They made it into a movie called On Colleen Cooen. It's a translation. The book was originally written in Irish, and the original Irish book was called On Colleen Cooen, which is The Quiet Girl. And the movie is an Irish language movie, On Colleen Cooen, which I don't think you can get on streaming yet. But when you can, I will highly recommend the film in the Irish language. Won an Oscar. But the book is just beautiful and kind of perfect. And it's the kind of book you'd read in an afternoon. And I would highly recommend it. There's nothing woke about it, by the way. It's just a lovely story. It's a little bit poignant, to say the least. But it's really beautiful. But anyway, I'm not going to say more about it than that. If you were looking for something, a lovely something to read, I would recommend that. So Hopefully next week we will have Phelan with us, and we will have Phelan with us next week. I will insist on Phelan being well by next week. Please God, he'll be in good shape for Monday for recording. But for now, that's enough for me. And thank you, always thank you for tuning in and listening. And anyone, by the way, who isn't on our database, subscribe at unreportedstoriesociety.com to get our weekly newsletters, our new weekly letter, because we have some very big news coming out that you will not want to miss. And yeah, so just subscribe, you know, subscribe, give us your email address, and we'll be writing probably, I think, this week with some very big news that I'm not able to share just yet, but that we'll be coming to you with by the end of the week. Okay, that's enough from me. God bless. Take care. Bye.